Succession number 26868, Reel 2.
With that?
In relation to you later becoming an airman, how were the airmen in the Battle of Britain being looked upon?
As heroes, generally. Because the general news level was pretty low.
How was Churchill seen?
Oh, as a possible saviour, after Chamberlain and so on. No, he was highly popular.
Did you hear him speak?
Yes.
What sort of impression did his speech on radio, presumably, give you?
One of confidence that he was up to it. And did see the situation that Hitler was no friend, which of course Chamberlain more or less did.
People talk of Hitler wanting to make peace with England. That's, you know, I'll have my bit on the continent, you can have the rest of your empire. How was that seen? How was that viewed by the average person?
With dismay.
Why?
Because he was the type who would enter some agreement like that and then promptly invade when everybody were being complacent. I think that was the general feeling. So, not on.
What were you hearing about the early involvement with the Australian troops in the war? Being involved in places like North Africa, for instance.
So much of this, the news was so well censored that one didn't really know. That was the main thing. We heard odd snippets. We knew that there was a division had gone to Middle East, and there was another division, I think, had gone to UK.
Where had you hoped you might be involved?
Well, I didn't. I thought I would do my training in Australia and then be prepared to go wherever required. It might be UK, it might be, because I think people were beginning to think at that stage that Japan was going to be an enemy before long.
I'm interested that you discuss the enemy. Well, obviously,
oh, I see where
the Italians were involved. How are the Italians seen?
I think none of the people really took the Italians terribly seriously. That on their own they wouldn't create too big a menace. But going back to the training, I thought I'd be trained and be prepared in Australia, but when suddenly, having done the initial training at Summers, they said right to the showgrounds in Melbourne, there was complete clamp on what was happening there. Then we put on the train to Sydney, and we arrived in Sydney in the middle of the night, and put on a ruddy ferry, and the next thing you could see was this enormous sheet of steel, and it was the Queen Mary were pushed in.
What were your impressions of the Queen Mary? Presumably you hadn't seen a ship like this before.
Oh, it was absolutely enormous. Conditions were pretty terrible. This area we're in here, there were
20 by 15.
Yeah, there were 96 of us in that, with about this between bunks and this. You couldn't sit up, you had to roll into the bed and so on. And being canard, they were keeping things costs down. They may have been fuel and so on, but the air conditioning wasn't very good.
Where were you placed on the ship?
Oh, way down in the guts.
How far down in the guts? Do you remember the deck?
I can't remember which deck. But that was my first experience of lots of people being seasick.
Must have been a very pleasant occasion in relation to the general sort of situation down there. Hot? Smelly?
It was. And if you went up on deck, you had the fire hoses put on you straight away because they were so frightened of somebody with a cigarette or lighting a cigarette. It would be picked up by U-boats. What happened was the Mary, Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth went together with a cruiser, HMAS, can't remember which one, was escorting us, escorted us. Sydney, round south of Tasmania, to Perth, refueled, to Trincomalee in Ceylon as it was. We did pass, obviously from looking at things in retrospect, pretty near the Sydney and the Cormoran scrap. And the worst time of my life, I think, was on the Queen Elizabeth in Trincomalee, outside Trincomalee Harbour, with a very high temperature and no fresh air and just nothing to do.
You mentioned, obviously, being on board this ship. How did you pass the time?
Lying in your bunk, wandering around some of the passages, which a hell of a lot of other people were doing the same thing, and eating some pretty bloody rotten food.
What did that consist of?
Well, rotten eggs and fairly grim tack, because a lot of it had been from UK, and they were having big trouble with rationing. They had revictualled in Sydney, and I think again here a bit here in Perth.
Had you been able to stop on the way?
When you say
before you got to Ceylon, had you been able to stop along the way? Were you stopped?
We only had two stops from Sydney, one at Perth out in Gage Roads, and the second outside Trincomalee Harbour, and the next stop was after a wild run up the Red Sea where the ship started to vibrate. We were told they were doing 33 knots because when we got into Suez, there were sunken ships everywhere. The whole harbour was sunken ships. In, they unloaded the 6,000 troops, woof, and were gone again. By this time, the Japs were in the war because we were at the Horn of Africa when Japan came into Pearl Harbor, December the 8th?
December the 7th.
7th.
And at the attack on Pearl Harbor, and 8th, Australia declares war on Japan. What was the feeling then to know that you were against the Germans, the Italians, and now the Japanese?
It wasn't a good feeling. A lot of apprehension.
How are the Japanese seeing?
Uh, as the sort of yellow peril, preferably to be avoided at all costs. But at that stage, I don't think people realised the extent of the Japanese forces. I'd never heard of the number of battleships, navy, army, air force that they had. Anyway, there was nothing I could do about it. We were on the way.
The concern, obviously, the Pearl Harbor, and had you heard, for instance, later on about the bombing of places like Darwin, for instance?
Darwin, we didn't hear anything, not a thing.
Did you hear about the fall of Singapore?
Yes. We heard about something before that. That was the when the battleships, was it the Prince of Wales and the there's another one. The Hood was sunk in the Atlantic, I think. There was another one. Two Royal Navy battleships were sunk, and then Singapore. And if I'd stayed in the army, I'd have been in the midst of the Singapore lot. There we go.
Well,
some of my friends were in this. I met up with them after the war, after they got back from Changi or whatever.
We're talking about the Prince of Wales and the Repulse.
The Repulse, sunk, that was it.
Sunk off in Malaya on the 10th of December.
Yeah.
You were mentioning that you might have been in the Singapore bash had you remained in the army. What was the process of transferring from one to the other?
From the army to the Air Force? Well, there was this big interview on this recruiting train, and they said, you're accepted, and then it was a matter of signing everything up right there and then saying, right, you've got this few weeks you've got, do this, this and this, learn more, do something else, and then turn up for at a recruiting station in Melbourne, which they were then taken down to Somers.
Well, let's talk about that period. Had you, when was it that you had the first chance of flying?
Not until I got to Rhodesia. And that was delayed quite a bit. Because we've gone as far as getting to Egypt. We spent about 3 weeks in Egypt and then got on an old India troop ship and went unescorted back down the Red Sea and down to Durban. Incidentally, the cruiser, the Royal Navy cruiser that escorted us up to Singapore from the middle of the Indian Ocean, was sunk off the Horn of Africa. We went round there without any escort. We stopped at Masawa in Eritrea, then Mombasa, and then Durban. And from Durban, the train to Rhodesia, and went into the transit camp in Rhodesia, and then had to wait for an opportunity to go to a flying school.
Let's talk about the trip. Obviously, you're seeing a different world. What were your impressions on these places?
Well, Egypt wasn't very good. Things were in a hell of a flap at that stage in 1941 because, you see, Montgomery hadn't taken over and everything was, Rommel was just running amok with the British forces and the Australian forces. And then shortly after that, there was quite a difference when Rommel took over and people's morale. When Montgomery took over, when people's morale started to show up a bit. But it was fairly low in Egypt, and as far as the camps were terrible, the food was appalling. We'd have starved without the various aid agencies like the Salvation Army, the TOCH and so on, that produced the odd bar of chocolate and an odd little snack to eat. Didn't have any money.
The sense of adventure building?
Oh yes, quite a lot. You never know, it was round the corner for the next day. Then it was rather different when we got to South Africa and up to Rhodesia. It was sort of away from the war zone, and in fact it was rather difficult to get information of what was happening. It was all pretty well censored.
You mentioned that you'd heard of the fall of Singapore. What was the importance that you understood of Singapore and the loss of it?
Well, it meant the Japanese had a sort of free run to attack Australia.
How did that make you feel? I mean, obviously worrying for him, you couldn't do anything about it, but your family was back in Australia.
That's right, it was very worrying. And also we weren't able to communicate very much, because we had one little thing about that big, that you could put what you could onto that, and then it was photographed and put down to about this, and then that was on this flying boat. So communication, we just didn't know. I was actually overseas for a week short of 4 years.
You're mentioning Egypt. This, and you mentioned Ceylon. These places must have been completely out of nowhere in relation to your experience.
Well, they were. It was a bit of a shock to the system, seeing Egypt, really.
Did you have a chance to take in the sights of Egypt?
Oh, no. Went into a ruddy transit camp. First of all, quarantined in a hospital because of a measles outbreak. And then we went to a transit camp, Abakir, which was just outside Alexandria. And then they just said, you're moving. We're on the train, and we moved around for a few days on the train and got back to Suez again and got on the troop ship to go to South Africa.
What was the situation like at this transit, this quarantine station, and how long were you to stay there?
The quarantine was actually a British hospital. That was a few days.
Your next stop, what was that like? What was the situation?
That was a transit camp at Abakir out of Alexandria. We had tents, palliasses, which were bit of hessian with straw inside, on the sand. There were no beds or anything like that. The odd blanket, at night it was colder than charity, hot as hell during the day. And all this was accompanied by everybody had jippy guts. Jippy guts was something that you had to have to believe. The pain in the stomach. At night you'd hear boom, 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 as somebody crashing out of the tent. You'd hear the feet rushing. Oh, shit. He got so far and he booped himself. And that was Egypt. It was the water. In spite of it being supposed to be boiled, but it was the water. It was full of bacteria. It wasn't a very happy sort of time. Then.
Here you are, signed up to fight a glorious war, and you're shitting yourself in Egypt. What? How did that make people feel?
A bit ropeable. There was still the sort of excitement about what's next round the corner, because we were hoping to get on somewhere or other with this flying training.
So let's talk about moving on to that period. What was involved in the early stages of arrival at Rhodesia and then the flying training that was involved?
Arrived in Rhodesia, went to this transit camp in Bulawayo, and then had to wait for entry into the elementary flying schools, which were flying tiger moths. I was sent to one which was the flying school for people to go on to bomb aircraft generally. But after a short while there, they said, "Oh, you should be on a fighter training thing." So when that course finished at near Bulawayo, the next one was the senior flying school, which was in central Rhodesia, which I went there and was training on Harvard.
Let's talk about the training. What did that involve?
Well, first of all, on the tiger moth was going solo after a few hours, and then the great interest of that, I found that was the sort of happiest time I'd had was in training in Rhodesia, because not only was the flying new, and I enjoyed it and was quite good at it, because I always had an above average classification, but I met such nice people there. In fact, at the senior flying school at Thornhill, became friendly with the chief native commissioner, who was high in government there, and his family, and whenever I said I could go off, his car and driver arrived at the station. I was picked up and taken there and then delivered back the next morning or whenever it was possible. So that I enjoyed. And I enjoyed the flying.
Well, and let's talk about that. You know, it's obviously the first time you went out. Let's describe that. When were you first taken up for a training flight?
That was a tiger moth. I enjoyed it. I'd had one flight before as a joyrider once in Victoria, but that was about 10 minutes. I enjoyed it immediately, and obviously had quite a fair aptitude, because always had the above average classification on that. And I had an instructor who was, he'd been on bombers in UK and so on, in the sort of phony war set up. And we had great fun going around game spotting, doing this, and testing the aircraft out, and then was even better when I went on to the senior flying school on Harvard aircraft.
What were you being told about flying, about the air war from this chap?
Well, everybody had heard about the Battle of Britain and the aces and so on there, and everyone was sort of hoping to be able to copy those same ones.
Were you being told about the German?
A little bit, from odd people.
What were you hearing about the Luftwaffe?
That they were a pretty formidable force, really. About that time was sort of beginning the changeover in aircraft. the Germans had been using the Stuka dive bombers and so on, and the old Heinkel and, what was the other one, bombers. And then the new fighters and bombers were coming in, like the Messerschmitts and the Focke-Wulfs, and the Ju-88s as the bombers were the main ones.
What were the ones to watch out for that you understood?
Well, the one that was most likely to be one that attacked you was the ME-109.
What were you told about the ME-109?
That it was about equivalent to the Spitfire. There wasn't much difference in it.
What about its weaponry?
Good. Because the Spitfire had the initially the just six 303s. So it wasn't sort of really heavily armed at all. Later on they had the 20mm cannon and four 303s. And then they had, I think later they put in 0.5s. But the Germans at that stage were quite a formidable fighting force. Later on, they were a bit depleted.
We'll talk about that later. Yeah.